Since the 1800s, Hickok & Boardman Insurance Group has been providing quality service and peace of mind to our clients. With our offices in Burlington, Stowe, and St. Albans, and our Dennis Ricker & Brown offices in Montpelier and Lynnonville, we are here when you need us.
It is time for Radio Vermont's news and public affairs program, Open Mic, with your guest host, Governor Jim Douglas. Phone lines to speak with Governor Douglas are open at 802-244-1777 and toll-free at 1-877-291-8255. And now here's your host, Jim Douglas.
Thank you, John. Good morning, everybody. Great to be here once again, filling in for Mike Smith. Mike is a great host of this program. He's had such a tremendous range of experience in the public and private sector, and he's away today because of some of his private sector experience. He was the president of Fairpoint Communications in Vermont for a number of years, and he's giving a speech at a big telecom conference today out of state. So we wish Mike all the best, and we'll do our level best here to maintain the high quality of his traditional programming. So thanks for tuning in, and we're going to have an interesting show today. We're going to start off with Scott Milne, the candidate for the United States Senate, who's with us to talk about his campaign, how it's different from some others, and what the prospects are for toppling a very long-tenured incumbent. And then we hope to have Randy Brock with us. You just heard his spot. Perhaps we'll ask him some questions about that. He'll be here to talk about his candidacy for lieutenant governor. At 10 o'clock, Debbie Bucknam is coming by. She's the candidate for attorney general, and a similar allegedly uphill task, but we'll ask Debbie about her thoughts and prospects and priorities. And we're going to wrap up this morning with Matt Dickinson, the political science professor at Middlebury College, a colleague there, who will talk about the presidential campaign. Certainly a lot of fodder for political scientists and pundits this year. And interestingly, Matt's been on sabbatical. He's back on campus now, but he spent quite a lot of time earlier in the year and through the summer traveling around the country attending presidential campaign events. So he's got a great perspective from his personal experience, and I think that'll be fun to hear about what his current thought is on the state of that race. Well, Scott Milne, welcome to Open Mic.
Great to be here with you, Mike. I mean, Governor Douglas.
Well,
Governor Douglas with the mic, I guess, eh?
Well, we look alike, I'm sure. We were kind of alter egos. Of course, Mike and I worked together in a couple of different capacities, and I think it got to the point where we could finish each other's sentences. So he's a great guy. Well, Scott, thanks not only for being here, but I want to thank you personally for stepping up to the plate to take on a challenge. As our listeners perhaps know, it's one that I assumed myself 24 years ago, trying to make the case to Vermonters that...
Were you a Boy Scout then, or holy schmoly?
Well, I was a little younger, but still I'd already served six terms as Secretary of State. So I tried to make the case to Vermonters that it was time for a change, that somebody shouldn't inhabit the United States Senate seat forever, but here we are 24 years later, and the incumbent is still there. So tell us about why you decided to run.
Thanks, Governor Douglas. As I think with Mike Smith, you know, I've got a good foundation in the private sector. And, you know, business 101, I think, is if you make an investment in something, you want to get a return on investment. I would argue one of the biggest problems we have in Washington that's really been rooted and grown, and I would argue Senator Leahy is a poster child for over the last 50 years, is this deadly concoction of career politicians propped up by special interest money. And just to diverge for a second, private businesses don't spend a lot of special interest money, so they don't get a return on investment. So I think if you look at, say, the pharmaceutical industry, which has spent somewhere close to $1 billion over the last 10 years lobbying people like Senator Leahy, what is the return on investment they're expecting from that? Clearly, I think you can look at this opiate epidemic that's ravaging places like Vermont and the entire country, and to me, it's impossible to argue that lobbying doesn't have at least play a hand in that, if not a major influence in that. So that's a bad return on investment. I looked for a good return on investment for the time and energy, myself, my family, the folks that I offered a voice to in the 2014 governor's race. How could we get a return on investment on that in 2016? And as I looked across who was on the ballot in 2016, in spite of all of the accurate and nice things I could say about the gentleman I'm running against, if I imagine being optimistic about doing everything I can so that my kids and grandkids are growing up in a state and a country that's as best as it can possibly be, for people that are on the ballot this year, Senator Leahy is the biggest impediment. And it's because of this deadly concoction of special interest money propping up people like Senator Leahy term after term after term. It was starting to be evident 24 years ago when you ran against him. I think you made that case. But there was an argument against it then that was maybe a little more credible. Today, it's not at all credible to say it's not a huge problem. If you agree with me, if you don't agree with me, if you think everything's great and the Senate is great and Congress is working great, you're not going to be voting for me. If you think things need to be, change, I'm offering a voice for that. And I think we've got a campaign that's designed to amplify our message that we need to get special interest money out of politics. I've taken a two-term pledge. We'll work to get term limits. We're going to get outspent maybe 100 to 1. So not only will we see, if we're successful, we'll see an incumbent senator lose for the first time since we've been popularly electing senators in Vermont, which is about 100 years. I believe we'll see the senior member of the United States Senate be toppled for the first time in American history. If we do that while we're being outspent 100 to 1 and running a clean campaign with no dirty, I would argue dirty, special interest money that's looking for a return on investment, I would say it's completely plausible that Vermont will do more to change America the day after the November 8th election than my opponent is going to achieve in the next 6 years. Everything I do after that is gravy, and I'll do a lot.
Well, I certainly have a sense of deja vu, as we've suggested, Scott. We're talking with Scott Milne, candidate for the U.S. Senate, because in 92 I pointed out that 96% of his campaign contributions came from outside Vermont. I received 100% of mine from inside Vermont and was outspent not 100 to 1, but about 6 to 1, actually. Mm-hmm. After the campaign, he did forswear PAC contributions for a while.
Yeah, through the Fred Tuttle race, right?
I guess so, but we're back at it. You mentioned the connection between campaign contributions and a return on that investment, and there have been a couple of examples recently that have been in the news. Tell us about those.
Sure. It seems, as you know, life is complicated, politics is complicated. This disruptive force is on our economy. I'm in the travel business. I think we were on the cutting edge of disruption brought on by the internet and changes. News media has been tremendously disrupted as well. There's going to be a lot of disruptive forces as we go forward. If you think old ideas that have been pretty stagnant for the last 42 years are going to be able to help our country adapt and be deft at continuing to play a leading role in the world, vote for Pat Leahy. I think we need to change things. I think if we look at what's going on, every time there's a story, I think it was Wells Fargo and Yahoo and Mylan and the iceberg of EB-5, which I think all in Vermont thought Senator Leahy was the godfather of EB-5 just because of what was going on in the kingdom, which turned out to be the biggest alleged financial fraud in our state history. There's five times as much money going through EB-5 projects in Hollywood. He's the godfather of Hollywood's EB-5 project. So every time there's a news story, it's got one thing in common. Patrick Leahy is a major recipient of donations from Yahoo, from Wells Fargo, from Mylan, from EB-5 interests all over the planet. They all want a return on investment from that. I could say a lot of good things about an EB-5 program, but one thing you'll know is I'm not saying good things about an EB-5 program because I'm benefiting from it in a campaign. I could say a lot of good things about a pharmaceutical company, but it's not going to be because I've got lobbyists paying $5,000 to sit around and have a cocktail with me and tell me what to say the next day. Patrick Leahy can say that, and it might be true, but there's an appearance that it's not true because of all the money that's tainted his campaigns.
Well, it's certainly significant. I think about how much I spent, and even in gubernatorial races, that's multiplied by several times, even just in the past 6 or 8 years. Your family has quite a history in politics, in government, both at the state and the federal level. Tell us about that.
Oh, thanks. One of the foundations, you know, first of all, I think some people don't take the prospect of a travel agent stepping up and being a credible United States senator as plausible. I argue the exact opposite. Our founding fathers designed a nation that was designed for people, travel agents, college professors, farmers, doctors, to step up and serve and go back and live in their communities under the laws that they made. I think if we look at George Washington, one of the greatest people in our country's history, in recent world history, could have turned the Continental Army into a militia, turned it back over to the people, could have probably turned us into some sort of imperial presidency, stepped aside after two terms. That's what our country's designed for. And if I look at my family history, my grandfather was a young lawyer from Barrie. I got elected as the first Republican between the Civil War and 1938, first Republican legislator from Barrie. Dean Davis actually ran 2 years before my grandfather and lost. And then Aiken was a freshman senator and goes, wow, this Milne guy can get elected in Barrie. I need somebody to run my office in Washington. My grandfather ran his office in Washington. So I grew up as a, I think probably starting when I was 6 or 7 years old, fishing with my grandfather a lot and just hearing great firsthand stories about George Aiken. So I know an awful lot about George Aiken from that, read a lot about him, had some good conversations with you and everybody else that's known him. And so I think there's a lot of George Aiken in what I plan to do, which is to be a centrist Republican that's not afraid of saying me too when the other side has a good idea. I think the New England Republican is essentially become extinct in American politics. It's way too polarized. It's not just the gentleman I'm running against is clearly one of the most partisan liberal people in the United States Senate, but there's way too many partisan conservatives as well. I'll be able to split the difference on that and hopefully be able to get things done. As you know, I also have a mom and a dad who served in the Vermont legislature. My mom, I think, again, did not run for the state legislature with a whole agenda of I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. Just ran, said I'm offering a voice to people. I'm naive enough to believe I can make a difference. A lot of people listening today know my mom firsthand. I'd ask you if you believe that my mom delivered on what she promised and that you've gotten to know me through a relationship with my mom. Please spread the word because, as you talked about, we're going to get outspent maybe 100-1. One of the reasons why this campaign has the potential to change America is because of that. The way we're going to win this race is by spreading the words at a grassroots level. Folks that have known my grandfather, my grandparents, and my parents, or my children, I think are great, tremendous assets of mine, and it's one of the reasons why perhaps this story is only possible in Vermont.
Well, I recall the last time seeing your mom was a couple of years ago when you launched your campaign for the governorship. And a lot of people thought that was impossible. And as we watched the returns coming in on election night, gosh, you darn near won.
Mm-hmm.
So that must have felt good.
I think it felt good for Vermont, too, Governor Douglas. I think it was an important time in Vermont history. I happened to be in the right place to offer a voice to an awful lot of people that I think maybe thought going into it we were a lot more outnumbered than we turned out to be. And I think we'll see what happens on November 8th. Maybe we'll see a replay of that again this year.
Well, it's an unusual year, to put it charitably, at the presidential level, for sure. And a lot of people think that maybe the polls don't reflect a lot of the uncertainty that people have. So you just never know what happens when people go into that booth and make a decision based on all the information they have at the time. So so best of luck to you, Scott. Tell us a little about some of the issues that you'd want to address if you're a United States senator. What motivates you in terms of changing federal public policy or doing some making some changes that would be good for the country's future?
Sure. I think the biggest problem we have in America, in the United States Senate, is when Dwight Eisenhower left office, Governor Douglas, if you recall, he had that famous farewell address, which warned America to be aware of the military-industrial congressional complex. And some people think that was beware of a growing military. It wasn't. That was a warning to beware of private businesses looking to get a return on investment by influencing legislation. He was a prophet. If you look at George Aiken, who was a U.S. senator from Vermont for 34 years and spent $5,000 total on all of those elections, even with an inflation adjuster, it's about what it costs a table of lobbyists to sit around and have a cocktail with Senator Leahy today. Senator Leahy is running a $6 million plus campaign. Almost $3.5 million of it's from special interests to get a Senate seat that he's held for 42 years already in Vermont against a travel agent. That speaks volumes to what's wrong. So we're coming in with a reform agenda, term limits, getting corporate special interest money out of politics, and bridging the partisan divide. So that's the umbrella over which I'll act. Once we get down to the sort of brass tacks of what we need to do, you know, Supreme Court, everybody's talking about Supreme Court. You know, my opponent's an obstructionist if it's a member of the other party. I won't be an obstructionist if it's a Democratic president. I think the U.S. Senate is complementary to the executive. You know, our role is to advise and consent. Hearings should definitely be held. If the hearings determine that somebody's not somebody I would vote for, I'll vote against them. But that's an important thing to move forward with.
You mentioned the legendary Senator George Aiken, for whom your grandfather worked. We're speaking, by the way, with Scott Milne, candidate for the U.S. Senate. You mentioned President Eisenhower, who governed in a very different era, and the two of them, of course, were in office at the same time. And during the 50s, the U.S. Senate was fairly evenly divided, but they worked together. They got along. They created the interstate highway system, for example, in the 50s, and Senator Ralph Flanders, the other Vermont senator during that decade, wrote in his memoir that there was great bipartisan cooperation. Nothing, he said, ever passed without support from both parties. Mm-hmm. And contrast that with what we see in Washington today. It's 180 degrees different, and no wonder Congress has a 13% approval rating or whatever it is today.
Yes, and I think even when you go into the 60s, Governor Douglas, you have George Aiken, who was one of Lyndon Johnson's more effective advocates on you know, his Great Society program. So you had clearly a situation where you know, Republican moderates like George Aiken were able to be part of a successful American future. George Aiken, as you know, got up in 1966 and essentially said to Lyndon Johnson, we should, regarding Vietnam, we should declare victory and get out. Probably the world would be a little bit better place today if Lyndon Johnson had paid attention to our great George Aiken.
Well, I guess it would, and certainly a different era and a spirit of bipartisanship. He used to have breakfast with Mike Mansfield, the Democratic Majority Leader from Montana, every day they were both in Washington, and we just don't see that today. They don't talk to each other. They don't like each other. They just don't get along. One of the strengths you bring to the campaign, as you mentioned earlier, is your business background. A lot of folks in Washington are career politicians or lawyers or both. What do you think the benefit is of that, somebody who's actually created jobs and run a small business?
Early this morning, I stopped for a conversation with a gentleman who I had not met before, who came up to thank me for running and talked about his small business and just the challenges of hiring people that can fulfill roles for him. But I would argue that this morning I was out at an event in Rutland County last night. A lot of great people there. Got home late, got up a little bit later than I usually do. But between 5:30 and 6:15 this morning, I was checking in on what was going on with my private business. So in 45 minutes this morning, I spent more time working in the private sector, creating jobs in the private sector, than my opponent has in the last 50 years. When I talk to, you know, what I read in the paper is, oh, we can't do without Senator Leahy's bacon that he brings home. That's what I read about from the 100 people in Vermont that control the press and think they know everything. What I hear about when I talk to Vermonters is they want somebody that understands what it's like to struggle to meet a payroll, to create jobs, and to, at a grassroots level, contribute to building a good economy. So I have a lot of experience with that. I think travel is one of the few businesses that was really on the early stages of being disrupted by the internet. And I would humbly say that my business made it through 9/11, made it through the economic downturn of 2009, and made it through all these ups and downs in the economy without eliminating jobs. We've actually grown through all of that. So I'm not saying I'm perfect. I'm not saying I'm not going to make mistakes as a United States Senator, but I bring a different perspective. And I think the perspective of career politicians who are being propped up election after election by special interest money is what's wrong with America. I think we saw that with campaign finance reports that were filed yesterday. My opponent in the last 3 months spent more money on hiring professional fundraisers to help him raise some money from Vermonters so he can claim he's not all funded by out-of-state donors. He spent more money just on fundraising than I spent on my total campaign. Again, those stories will amplify the message of Vermont's a special place where Scott Milne's story is only possible. November 9th will be a great day if you want to change what's going on in the United States Senate if Scott Milne wins across the country, I believe, humbly in my soul, and I'm grateful to everybody that shares that belief with me and is working to help me win.
Well, he's created jobs for fundraisers, though, I guess.
Yeah, fundraisers. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, your story is a little about one that you talk about on the campaign trail, and that's Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. You've actually been handing out copies of that
yes.
book, right?
The movie, the yes. Movie. Uh-huh. Yes, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. My mom, thanks for mentioning my mom, Governor Douglas. My mom was inspirational, you know, first woman president of the local Chamber of Commerce. You think about starting a business as a woman in 1975, pretty pioneering. Just a great inspiration in my life. But growing up, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington was my mom's favorite movie. So we watched it a lot. So it's a little bit of paying tribute to my mom. But I think if you watch that movie, and particularly if you step back and put in perspective that it was 1939 when that movie was filmed, very similar to now, there's a lot of perilous things going on globally. And we're still not really out of this economic downturn. So I think there's some parallels in the timing. I think the nation and the planet are at the threshold of really perilous times. I don't believe that continuing to have the same old in Washington, especially the same old that's career politicians propped up by special interest money is really going to be the best way to fix things. I'm channeling the energy of Marion Milne and the script a little bit, I guess, if Mr. Smith Goes to Washington and trying to topple the incumbent.
It worked for him, right?
It did, although, you know, like Pat Leahy got started in public office by getting appointed by Governor Hoff to a district attorney job. So Mr. Smith got appointed to his position. He didn't win the election, but he did change things once he got there.
Well, Scott Milne, you've been out and about the state quite a lot. What do folks say to you on the campaign trail? What's on their minds?
Well, the three things that I hear the most, and I focus on talking to people and having good conversations more than just trying to, you know, the typical campaign 101 is you try to shake as many hands as you can. I was at the Barton County fair up in Orleans County with another gentleman who's running statewide. You know, we went into the restaurant there at the fairgrounds, said hello to everybody in about 15 minutes. He probably had more personal contact with people, said, oh, I met so-and-so, than I did in the 3 hours that I was there. But I had four or five really good conversations where I got to understand what people really think and believe. And that's what inspires me. Saying hello to people is great, too. But I like understanding and listening and then thinking about it and then deciding how to act. Overall, the three things that I clearly hear continuously is, Pat Leahy's been there too long. It's time for a change. There's this question about, at what point are you too old to do a job? And I think that's a good question. On those two points, I really listen to people. The third point that a lot of people believe is that we can't afford to do without Pat Leahy because he brings home the bacon. That's one of the things I hear the most. And you're a good scholar on this, and I would ask you to ask Matt Dickinson when he comes on as well, because it quite frankly is not true. I mean, I would grant you that he's got more bacon that he's brought home to name things after himself than anybody else in America today probably. But if you look at the way our nation was founded, our Constitution and our country is designed to attract small, less populated states like Vermont to join the Union. And that's because we get two U.S. senators. Vermont's got, what, 1/500th of the country's population, but 2% of the United States Senate. There's a small state advantage baked into the United States Constitution. When Jim Jeffords came out and endorsed Stuart Ledbetter in 1980, one of the things he said was, these are my words, not his words, but it's basically driving him crazy that Pat Leahy shows up every Friday and Monday to hand out another check, pretending he's the guy that he created the money. And Jeffords then said, you know, I just want to make sure everybody knows Stafford and I do just as much or more to get this money than Leahy does. I think Welch and Sanders and I will work very well together to make sure Vermont gets its fair share of things. If you look at the six states with one congressional district, there's some pretty good data over the last 10 years, which has all been under Pat Leahy's senior membership of the United States Senate. Vermont's usually five or six out of that as far as different ways of analyzing what we get for money. So the whole thing that we bring home the bacon is more a sign of Senator Leahy's machine and ability to get things said in the press that don't really get fact-checked.
Well, interestingly, a lot of that bacon is manufactured from debt. It's passed on to our kids, right? So, interesting perspective. Well, this has been fun, Scott. Thanks for coming by, and I've certainly enjoyed the chance to spend a little time with you, other than at large events as we did last night with a lot of people for whom with whom you had to interact, and that was a lot of fun. But we wish you all the best. It's a important task. We hope that everybody in our listening audience will get out and vote, and it's really nice to have you here this morning. Scott Milne, candidate for the United States Senate.
Thanks for being with you, Governor Douglas.
We'll take a break and be back with another candidate, Randy Brock. Open mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. Jim Douglas sitting in this morning for Mike Smith. We appreciate your joining us, and I hope you enjoyed our conversation during the first half hour with Scott Milne, candidate for the United States Senate. In this half hour, we're going to be chatting with Randy Brock, a longtime and great friend who is our candidate for lieutenant governor. And in the second hour, we're going to start off with Debbie Bucknam, the candidate for attorney general, and then talk with Matt Dickinson from Middlebury College, a political science professor and a pundit extraordinaire, about the campaign season that's coming to a climax in just a few weeks. So, Randy Brock, welcome to Open Mic.
Well, good morning, Jim.
Thanks so much for taking time out of a busy campaign schedule to be on the air this morning. Tell us, for listeners who may not be as familiar with your background, about your experience in the public and private sector, and what prepares you to serve as our next lieutenant governor.
Well, as I say, I wasn't born in Vermont, Jim, but I got here just as soon as I could. I got here by way of Middlebury College, as some other public officials in Vermont have.
You bet.
And after I graduated from Middlebury, I found I didn't really know how to make a living, so I joined the Army and learned a trade. And I was a regular Army officer. I was in the Military Police Corps, and I served in a variety of roles, which frankly taught me a lot. Management analyst, I was a logistics officer, but I was also a military police operations officer and a criminal investigations officer. After leaving the Army after about 5 years, I came back to Vermont, and I started a business in the second bedroom of my mobile home. It was a private security business. It started with me, and it grew eventually to a company that employed over 1,000 people in 16 states. And I sold that company after a number of years and consulted for a while. Never thought I'd go to work for a large company, but I did. I went to work for one of my clients, Fidelity Investments. And for Fidelity, I worked literally all over the world, but 100% of the time I lived in Vermont. My typical day was to get up at 5 in the morning and drive to the airport in Boston and fly to Boston, or drive to the airport in Burlington, fly to Boston, take the subway to work, and come home at night. And I did that every day for about 15 years. After leaving Fidelity in 2003, I ran for state auditor and was fortunate enough to win. And so I served as Vermont state auditor. People always ask me, the big question about being auditor was, what does the auditor do? And I had to summarize it into a soundbite. There are five constitutional officers in Vermont, and the job of the auditor is to protect you from the other four. And it's a full-time job.
Even though I held three of those other offices, I won't quarrel with you.
After I served as auditor, I also served two terms in the state Senate, representing Franklin County and the northernmost town, Alberg, in Grand Isle County. And then I ran for governor in 12, Unfortunately, I did not win, and so I'm running for lieutenant governor now.
Well, it's a great wealth of experience in both the public and private sector, and you did a great job running 4 years ago. It's very difficult, especially for the first reelect, I think, of a governor. We have such brief terms here. But then 2 years after that, Scott Milne, our earlier guest on the show, ran and did extremely well, came quite close. So you paved the way. Well, tell us about the campaign this year. What are people telling you on the campaign trail? What issues are you raising with them?
I'm hearing more than anything else during the campaign about affordability, about jobs and the economy, that is the issue that, more than anything else, is on Vermonters' minds. We've been losing ground. We do not have the number of jobs that we had in the beginning of the Great Recession in December 2007. The number of people actually working and the number of people in Vermont's labor force has fallen. We see this loss of people in the 25 to 44-year-old age range who either pack up and leave or who've given up on our job market. And that's a concern. Our population growth is very, very low. We're 49th in the nation in population growth, and that is having an effect. So all in all, it does come back to having a vibrant economy, having an economy that's better than what we have now, will make a tremendous difference in the way that people feel and in what they think. And that's what they're telling me.
Well, Scott Milne and I were at an event in Rutland last night, and southern Vermont has been particularly hard hit with a loss of population. Rutland County has lost about 1,500 people in the last 5 years. So they're quite concerned and are trying to rally the Chamber of Commerce and other organizations to work with public officials to address it. But as you say, it's not rocket science. It's a matter of having a place where folks can afford to live, right?
That's absolutely correct. And if we look at almost all of the problems that we talk about in Vermont, ranging from the opiate epidemic to the high cost of education, improving our economic climate will make a material difference in improving all of those things. And that's where, as lieutenant governor, my focus will be, is to be a catalyst for new ideas, a catalyst for raising the consciousness of how we can go about getting the jobs and the economic activity that we want in order to make Vermont better.
We're chatting this morning with Randy Brock, former state auditor and state senator, candidate for lieutenant governor. Randy, on the topic of creating jobs and jump-starting our economy, you've had some specific, very creative ideas that you've been advancing on how we might generate more revenue without raising taxes. Tell us about some of those.
Well, I think that's what's really critically important. Vermonters are taxed out at doing things that add to taxation. My opponents have a tendency to call it investment, but what it really means in most cases is raising taxes and getting more programs and getting us further away from where we ought to be. We've had some great success in a few areas in Vermont in which we raise money from other people. Our captive insurance industry is a classic example of what we can do and what we can do well, and we need to replicate that. Now, for those who aren't familiar with captive insurance, it's simply a case of large corporations, sometimes trusts, typically out-of-state entities, that instead of buying insurance to protect their businesses from liability, they form an insurance company and they pay premiums to that insurance company. Where that insurance company is located, where it's domiciled, where its books and records are kept, Vermont has become the number one in the nation for captive insurance companies, and it's an industry that brings us $32 million a year in tax revenue, almost all paid for people outside of Vermont, and it adds about 1,400 well-paying jobs. That's a lesson for us to replicate that in other areas. In replicating it, there are several things that I'm working on along those lines. The first is, we know that within the next 15 years or so, we're going to have the greatest transfer of wealth in American history as the baby boomers retire. Well, Vermont is well situated as a state to form trusts, insurance instruments, or other kinds of unique financial products that are domiciled here that can do what we do with the captive insurance industry to make Vermont a center for doing particular kinds of jobs or serving particular kinds of products well. In financial services, that's a classic example of a place that needs the same kind of regulatory environment that we have with captive insurance. And what Vermont has done with captive insurance is it's gotten a group of really highly trained and highly qualified state employees who do a superb job, who do a job in which they are fast, they're responsive, and they make the rest of the world in captive insurance look sad. We can do that in insurance and trust as well, and so I've been working with a couple of financial services companies to say what kinds of products that we design that are unique that fit that kind of mold. So that's one idea.
Well, it's I was just going to add to that. Captive insurance has done such a great job for us. It brings in more money every year than the state lottery, for example. And it started in the 80s, as I recall, during Governor Snelling's tenure, and has enjoyed strong bipartisan support ever since. So you're right. I've always wondered, what's the next niche like the captive insurance industry? And it's exciting that you're giving some thought to that. So, yeah, tell us about some others.
Well, one of the things, you know, if you take a look at where we are with that disaster called Vermont Health Connect, and you look at the business model that we typically use, we don't do information technology particularly well in Vermont. That has not been our core competency. And there are lessons learned from that. What we have been doing is we've been hiring multinational companies whose business model, to a large extent, is to go to other countries and bring people in who are system engineers, who are process people in the information technology area, bring them into the United States under H-1B visas, and then they do the work here and then go back to the country of origin. We could do a much better job if we focused some of our job development and job training and also some of our recruiting to build an information technology industry here in Vermont. We've approached this so much from the standpoint that, well, we need to have a particular group of skills for this particular contract to go away until we have the next contract. But what we're forgetting is that we have backlogged right now almost $750 million just of state projects alone to replace our aging legacy technology systems in state government, not to mention all the opportunity in the private sector. To me, that's a great opportunity for Vermont to begin building our own technology industry, because these are skills that we use over and over again, and what we've been doing is we buy the skill today at a very high price, and then we throw it away, and we don't present the jobs and opportunity for Vermonters, for prospective Vermonters to move here to join a growing industry, and for that matter, to use immigration as a means, again, for increasing both our workforce and our population. So I think we have an opportunity to do it slightly differently, using smaller, more specialized firms in each of the niches that we have in information technology, and then focus on building an integration capability to bring these skills together as needed on the projects that we have down the road.
It's really exciting. We're chatting with Randy Brock, candidate for lieutenant governor, and he's been discussing some of the creative ideas he has for growing the economy, consistent with Vermont values, in ways that will provide opportunities for Vermonters and address our demographic and economic challenges. And there's one other, Randy, I heard you talk about recently that I thought was fascinating, and that's the rental car initiative.
Well, we've been working with some of the rental car companies. There are still some roadblocks in terms of equity as far as the states are concerned, but in particular, my focus is to say, how could we get some of the major rental car companies to take a look at Vermont and domicile more cars in Vermont? You know, when you go to rent a car at the airport in Burlington and you look at the license plates of the cars, they're from all over the United States. It's rare that you will see a Vermont plate among those fleets. My goal is to say to the rental car companies, can we make it particularly attractive to you to domicile more of your fleet in Vermont? Not necessarily 100% of your fleet. We understand there needs to be interstate equity, but a greater number of cars in Vermont, for a small number to us, is of cars, is actually huge as a percentage of our registrations. So if we went to rental car companies, the major ones, and say something like, look, if you domicile 1,000 or more cars from your fleet in Vermont, we won't charge you a registration fee. We won't charge you a title fee. We won't even charge you for your license plates for the first 3 years of ownership. The only thing that we will look to you to for is that when you sell the vehicle, that you pay a fee of, cost, say, 3 to 5% of the sale price of the vehicle to the state as a title transfer fee, and that's a fee that you can pass on to whoever buys the cars. Now, the net effect of all of that, if we could get even 5% of the rental cars in the U.S. domiciled in Vermont, that could produce a revenue stream of $40 or $50 million a year just by that alone. Again, there are roadblocks, there are difficulties in doing it. It's not going to be easy, and we're still working through a potential methodology, but it's certainly worth exploring.
Well, $40-50 million would almost close the gap that the current regime seems to find every year as they begin to prepare the general fund budget. So that would be very helpful indeed.
One other thing that I'd also mention, you know, we have this cloud cast over the EB-5 program, which has been a horrible result that has given Vermont and Vermont's EB-5 regional center a black eye. We certainly need to fix that, working with our federal partners to try to make those investors whole, if we can, in some way, shape, or form, and also the Vermont vendors who seem to be left on the hook. But that being said, I wouldn't throw EB-5 out with the bathwater. It's a program that allows people to invest from $500,000 to $1 million. These are foreigners who've been vetted by the federal government, and then who are able to get a green card to come and live in the United States. I'm thinking of two things about EB-5 in order to clean it up, to provide the kinds of controls and checks and balances that are needed. And then once you do that, to look at EB-5 as in an entirely different way, instead of as a private enterprise project in which we have difficulty exerting the oversight and control, to look at it as a public infrastructure possibility. And the one beauty of that is you don't even have to change the law to do it. The federal law already has a provision in it that allows EB-5 monies to be used for public infrastructure. Pennsylvania Turnpike Authority is doing it, the Southeastern Pennsylvania Transit Authority, the state of Washington. Many public institutions throughout the United States are using EB-5 money. Now, that being said, we have a huge task to clean up the lake. We have aging roads, bridges, and highways that need reconstruction. We have municipal projects, some of which have funding sources through TIF or what have you, that are potential places that EB-5 money could be used. There are a variety of different ways in which to structure that. Now, clearly, EB-5 money is not free money. It has to be paid back. Bonds are one of the ways to do it. But I believe we could structure the use of EB-5 money to do some of these projects that we have to do anyway, and to do them much less expensively. The reason being because EB-5 payouts tend to be much, much lower than even the bond rates that the state would pay if it borrowed the money, one. Two, you could structure it in a way that it doesn't eat up our bonding capacity and doesn't cut into the quality of our high-quality bond ratings. And the beauty here is that because the interest rates are so low, we could save millions of dollars in lower borrowing costs by using EB-5 as an instrument. And there's one more thing beyond that that makes it even more interesting. We talked about earlier population. We never have asked people who've invested in EB-5 in Vermont, gee, wouldn't you like to consider becoming a Vermonter? Wouldn't you like to, instead of invest your money and then go live in California, why not become part of our community? We always go out and we look for immigrants who are poor and destitute, which is a great thing to do. It's a good thing to do. But wouldn't it be nice to have some wealthy immigrants who could enrich our communities, add kids to our schools, and be part of Vermont?
Indeed. Randy Brock, our candidate for a lieutenant governor. We've just got a few minutes left, Randy, but I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you about some of the curious things that your Democrat/progressive opponent has been saying, or maybe it's progressive/Democrat, on the campaign trail. Some strange comments about ethnic and racial things, some ethical breaches in terms of his finances. Could you just touch on a couple of those for our listeners?
Well, I think the important thing to think about is that when you elect a lieutenant governor, you're really also potentially voting for a governor. Because five times in Vermont history, it's happened. The lieutenant governor has had to take over. So this is an issue about trust, about judgment, about responsibility. One of the things that David did is he held a party to talk about race, a party with a cash bar and music and a good time, which I thought was highly inappropriate. I think one of the editorial writers wrote it best, as it almost looked like someone who saw a crowd and then ran to the front in order to get a position of appearing to be a leader. He's made a number of really insensitive and offensive racial comments, including using a paid employee who tweeted and retweeted some information that actually accused me of being a racist, tacitly supporting racism, which was just utterly offensive and beyond the pale. And I've called him out on it. In 12 years of public life, I've never raised a race as an issue in a campaign and had no intention of doing so now, but I can't let these kinds of remarks and actions pass. And he keeps doing it. He keeps making remarks and comments. He tracks his financial acumen to having a Jewish father, which I think, again, is entirely inappropriate. He says he can't talk about the illicit black market in drugs because saying black market would be inappropriate. It's dumb stuff like this that I just really question his judgment.
Well, let's hope the voters see through all that and reach the right conclusion as we get close to the election in just a couple of weeks. Well, Randy Brock, thanks so much for taking time out of a busy schedule. I know you're on the run and will be nearly 24/7 for about three more weeks, but it's great to have you on the show today, and I want to wish you all the best in the election campaign. I hope you'll have a chance to provide leadership to our state once again.
Jim, thank you very, very much.
Randy Brock, candidate for lieutenant governor. We appreciate his calling in from the campaign trail. Well, we'll take a break for some messages from our sponsors, news, and chat with someone from Vermont Media News, I assume, after the hour as well. And then we're going to have Debbie Buckham in studio. Debbie is the candidate for attorney general. With all the other campaign noise out there, there hasn't been as much focus, perhaps, on that race, but a very important office in our framework of government. And we'll have a chance to chat with Debbie about the campaign and her hopes for the office in the next couple of years. So we'll be back in a few. Jim Douglas in for Mike Smith. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic with Jim Douglas sitting in for Mike Smith, who's away today. Mike will be back tomorrow, I believe, and for the rest of the week. But he's got another commitment today, and I'm happy to be here in his stead. Also happy to be chatting with some great Vermonters over the first half hour and again in the second half hour. And we're going to talk with Debbie Buckham in just a couple of minutes. Debbie's the candidate for attorney general, and we'll learn all about her experience and her thoughts for the office. But before we do that, we're going to go to Talk Media News and have a conversation with Bob Ney. Good morning, Bob.
Hey, good morning, Governor. How are you?
Well, I can't.
I love that, Gov. I started volunteering for a governor. That's how I got in this business.
Is that right? And look at you now.
Governor James A. Rhodes of Ohio.
It's interesting. I was on the staff of Governor Dick Snelling of Vermont when Rhodes was in office.
Oh, yes. That's how I started.
I remember meeting him at an RGA meeting, Republican Governors Association meeting once. So an outspoken gentleman, as I recall.
Yes, he was.
Well,
yes, sir.
Well, interesting times. T-minus 3 weeks, I guess. Exciting things going on there in our national capital.
Well, there are, and of course, it's a lot different than the days when I ran for Congress and you were in the governorship. Things have changed a lot, especially in the media and elections. But tomorrow night's the big night. Talk Media News that I work for. We have some people going to be at the debate, but I still don't think the whole thing's over with. Although Hillary Clinton has a lead, I assume Donald Trump is going to come out swinging with the WikiLeaks, with his use of quid pro quo. This is the first WikiLeaks that actually is beginning to get traction in the sense of the Washington Post and the New York Times, carrying about carrying a story about the FBI talking with the State Department, not that Hillary Clinton directly spoke, you know. And I hate to just bring up that issue, but, you know, this election is boiled down to Donald Trump's sex tape and Hillary Clinton's WikiLeaks. Mm-hmm. I will say this, though. I must say this, Governor. I think that tomorrow night, moderator-wise, because we all raised the moderators, Chris Wallace is probably going to really do every level best effort to bring this to issues, mm-hmm. which has been void.
Yeah. Well, I was on my treadmill watching the last one. I thought it was a good way to get rid of my nervous energy, and I kept track on my little digital clock. It was about 25 minutes into the debate before there was a substantive issue-oriented question. It was weird.
I actually watched the debate myself on a treadmill at Planet Fitness.
How about that?
That's true. I can't make that up. That's what I did.
Great minds think alike.
That's it.
Well,
trying to keep my sense about myself. And then the only other thing I did want to mention is Mosul in Iraq, because 20,000 some Iraqis, you know, in force are there. We have some advisors, whatever you want to call our people involved, our military. We've done mainly some bombing strikes. They're going to do a full force effort. I don't think they're going to be able to wrap it up in a couple of weeks, as some people have suggested. I think this one will go a couple of months before they can take the city back.
Well, of course, some think maybe we need to get more engaged over there to help the local forces, but we'll
sure.
see. Well, and Congress is, of course, not in session. They're out trying to keep their jobs, right?
I'm going to put on my old congressional hat. They are in their in-district work period.
Well, I ran into one of our senators.
Respect to my colleagues.
I ran into one of our senators on a flight in the last few weeks, and I said, "Well, back from your 7-week vacation."
Well, that's what all the radio hosts that I talk to say that, and I always say, in-district work period. That's what the staff used to say.
Yeah, okay.
I always said, the day that started, so many planes were fired up to go overseas that if you had a dollar for each one of them, you could make a nice campaign contribution.
Well, while we got you, Bob, let me take advantage of your experience. Everybody talks about the toxicity and Washington now, how it's polarized. Folks don't talk to each other down there. They don't like each other in many cases. Is there any way to restore civility and collegiality among folks in the Congress?
Well, it's an interesting question. I came into Congress with Charlie Bass from, you know, your region,
yeah.
And a lot of other people. I was in that freshman class that made Newt Gingrich the speaker.
Oh.
And everybody thought it was bombastic, but we actually got a lot done, frankly, with Bill Clinton, a lot, and kind of we're in lockstep, you know, as a conference. That's gone because the Republican Party has fought each other internally, but the amount of incivility is huge. Bills that we passed back when wouldn't even get a hearing today. So I think it's just disintegrated so bad that eventually, if enough people complain, maybe at least some working partnerships can develop, but it's going to take leadership internally out there for people to do that. I think it's gotten quite bad.
Seems to be. I talked with our Congressman Peter Welch, who's also the Republican nominee. He's on your ticket, Debbie.
Right. Is that right?
We have our candidate for Attorney General here in
the
studio.
Great.
But anyway, Peter says, I don't even know most of my fellow Democrats, just the ones who are on my committee, because, as you know, they float in down there Tuesday, they're home Thursday, they just don't interact. So.
Sure.
Oh, well.
It's changed.
Yeah, not for the better. But not since the good old days when you and I were in office.
It was different.
Well,
I sound like I'm getting old, and I am, but it really was a different era.
I agree. Well, Bob, thanks so much.
Thank you,
we'll
Governor,
be
so
watching
much.
Tomorrow night and see what happens.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Bob Ney from Talk Media News joining us from Washington, D.C., former congressman from Ohio with quite a long perspective on the deliberations of our national government. But let's come closer to home. It's great to have Debbie Bucknam in studio. Debbie is the candidate for Attorney General of our state. Debbie, welcome.
Thank you.
Great to have you on WDEV News Radio. And I was saying earlier that everybody's focused on presidential race and governor and Senate and all that, but we've got other contests out there, notably yours, and the Office of Attorney General will have a new occupant for the first time in a long time. and we obviously hope it'll be you. So tell us about your experience, your background, and what you would bring to that that office.
Well, thank you, Governor. It's great to be here. My professional experience is this. I graduated from Vermont Law School in 1979, and right after I graduated, I went into private practice. I've been in private practice for 37 years as a trial lawyer. The first year I was in Montpelier, and then I moved to Hardwick, and for the last 30 years I've been in St. Johnsbury running my own business. So I have represented individual Vermonters and small businesses during that period of time. So that's what I bring to the Attorney General's office, a sort of Northeast Kingdom values and small business values.
And not experience as a government lawyer, which is what the other candidate has done principally. You've been representing real people with real problems, sometimes perhaps at not the best points in their lives, right?
That's right. They usually come to me when they're in some sort of trouble, either of their own making or someone else's.
And I know you've raised some issues on the campaign trail that I'm sure come from that experience, and we should talk about some of them. One is helping small business, because you run a small business, as you say. You've got some employees. You have to meet a payroll. You know what it's like for a lot of folks out there and around the state. Tell us how you think state government, through the Attorney General's office, could be more helpful to small business owners.
Yes. Over the years, I have noticed the increased frustration of my clients when dealing with state government. And so what I would propose when I am Attorney General is this. We're going to set up in the Public Protections Division of the Attorney General's office what I'm calling a Citizen Small Business Protection Unit. And that unit will be, for citizens and small businesses who are having difficulties with state government. Either they're not getting their permit, they're not getting a phone call back, they're getting two different answers to the questions they have. They can call the Attorney General's office, and we can work with the government agency to see if we can solve the problem. Well, it'll be like an ombudsman program. Those programs are all over the country and actually all over the world, in 120 countries, and they work. So we are would hopefully be sort of a third voice to talk to the agency and see if we can advocate for the Vermonter or the small business to solve their problem.
Of course, in some cases, as I recall, the Attorney General's office has an assistant attorney general located in agencies, the larger ones. And in other cases, when I was Secretary of State and Treasurer, there was a assistant attorney general assigned to me, so I had someone who was the regular contact. So there's an involvement in a lot of the agencies of government through the AG's office now, and this would be a logical extension of that role, right?
That's right. There are a lot of assistant attorneys general in different agencies. Some agencies have their own attorneys, and some don't. That's correct. So, yes, I think the Attorney General can work with the agencies. You know, as you know, Governor, there are a lot of really good people in state government who work hard and want to do what's right. And so I think we can work with state officials, state employees, to get these problems solved.
We're talking with Debbie Bucknam this morning, a candidate for Attorney General, about her experience, about some of the ideas that she'd bring to the Attorney General's office. You've been talking a lot about the opioid problem, as have many other people been discussing it. It seems insidious, growing. I was in Rutland last night with Scott Milne and had a long chat with a mother who's raising her granddaughter because her daughter is an addict. And incredibly, last evening while we were there, the daughter had another encounter with the police. Was found in a car with somebody who was peddling, I guess. And it seems to be a growing problem. I certainly saw it when I was in state government. It's classless in the sense that it's not just people who were down on their luck or in lower socioeconomic strata. It's affecting everybody, isn't it?
It really is. And that's the other thing I've seen over the years, the growing opioid epidemic problem and how it's devastating our families. I have clients who are recovering addicts who are struggling to keep their children and, as you say, grandparents who are taking care of kids. It's awful. It's just a terrible, terrible epidemic. And what I see from state government is this. Governor Shumlin spoke almost 3 years ago now about the opioid epidemic, and he was absolutely right to do so. The problem that I see is that state government has focused almost exclusively on treating the illness, treating the addiction. And, of course, you have to do that with any kind of disease epidemic. My concern is that the state government hasn't focused on prevention. We don't want our kids to even start. And believe me, I know recovering addicts, as I said, in my practice, and not one of them ever wanted to start. So what we need to also focus in on is prevention. How do you prevent our kids from starting down this path and becoming sick with this addiction? So I look to what the government did with another disease addiction. Now, it's not a perfect analogy, but we had a nicotine addiction epidemic back in the 20th century and into this century. And one of the stories I tell is my husband and I were married in 1966, 50 years ago.
Happy anniversary.
thank you. And
you were a child bride.
Yes. And neither Charlie or I smoked, but we got for our wedding presents 3 or 4 ashtrays.
Interesting.
Yes. So the culture has definitely changed. I don't know if you can buy an ashtray anymore. So what did we do to reduce the use? We did two things. One is we made it less accessible and more expensive. And the third thing, we actually did three things. And the third thing we did was educate the public. So using those models, we need to make drugs less accessible and more expensive so people don't start. And one way to do that is through law enforcement, making sure that the drug traffickers are apprehended, detained, and convicted so that their poison doesn't pour into the state like it's doing right now. And so that will reduce the availability. It will increase the price. So that's one thing that we could do to start the prevention program. The other thing, of course, is, as I've said, education. The legislature in 2013 passed a statute tasking the Agency of Education to implement a comprehensive drug education program, and they haven't done it yet. They've issued a report in 2015, but they really haven't gone down that path. And attorneys general across this country are implementing education programs and encouraging education programs amongst both school children and the public. And so I think that is an area that the attorney general can be effective in this state.
Well, I think that's right. The mom I chatted with in Rutland last night would certainly agree with you. She said, I'm not cutting my daughter any slack. She's made some choices that are wrong and detrimental to her own life and that of her young daughter. But she said, I really don't think the dealers have been dealt with severely enough. They don't get sometimes they're sent to rehab and then they're out in a fairly short time peddling again. So it's really a multifaceted approach. I called it deter back a few years ago to look at education, treatment, enforcement, and rehabilitation. All of those areas have to be addressed. But you're right, if we can get folks to not choose to start down that path, we'll be a lot better off. This is Debbie Bucknam in studio today, our candidate for Attorney General. We're talking about the opioid epidemic in Vermont, how serious it is, how it's causing pain and despair for a lot of families. It's taking a lot of lives.
That's right.
I remember seeing when I took office 14 years ago, the rapid increase in the number of OD deaths that we were experiencing, the number of visits to our emergency departments, and it's just continued to escalate ever since.
That's correct. It's getting worse and worse, and the deputy commissioner of the Department of Health just said a couple of weeks ago that the epidemic has not reached its peak. And
wow.
I found that really disturbing. If we had a cholera epidemic, the Department of Health would not just say, oh, it hasn't reached its peak. They would be talking about how we're going to stop it from increasing and what resources we're going to use to keep it from spreading. So we really need a focus. And by the way, the other way we're going to focus on it in the Attorney General's office is we're going to bring everybody together. The Attorney General from Massachusetts, the Democratic Attorney General from Massachusetts, did that. She brought in a task force right from day one to bring in everyone involved in this epidemic, from law enforcement, education, the medical community, the recovery community, the victims and their families, corrections, to see to do an inventory. What programs are working, what programs are not working, and also to find out from the experts what they think we need to do to institute prevention programs in the state.
Well, an insidious problem, to be sure. And I like your analogy with smoking. It's not precise, as you mm-hmm. suggest, but we had some real success with that, largely through preventive efforts. You mentioned your experience with the ashtrays. My dad smoked while he was in the Navy before I was born, and I'm told that shortly after I came along, he thought, gosh, I don't want my kids to see me smoking, and so he cut it out before I ever observed it. And if we can just encourage more young parents to make that choice and continue our efforts in the schools and other venues, I think we can make some progress. And it's a real challenge, and you've got a good perspective on it from dealing with clients and who've had that problem.
That's right. Yes.
Let me ask you about crime generally, Debbie. We have a very low rate in Vermont. I guess we're the lowest now, which is great. On the other hand, the drug problem seems to lead to some larcenies and petty crimes of various kinds, doesn't it? I mean,
that's right.
What's the status of criminal behavior in Vermont, and what should we be focusing on?
Well, you're right. Vermont has the lowest violent crime rate in the nation. And since the United States is a fairly safe country, it's probably one of the lowest in the world. So that's great. But you're right, the opioid epidemic is fueling criminal behavior. And it hasn't shown up yet in the statistics, but I hear it all the time from people about people they know who have been robbed or burgled or stores that have been broken into and so forth. So people are feeling feeling that the crime is increasing. So what to do about it? I do think the focus has to be on the opioid epidemic, and because I think that is the fuel for any increase in crime that we have. And here's the other thing about that. In Vermont, as you know, we have elected state's attorneys in every county, and they're elected every 4 years, and the attorney general is elected for every 2 years. So the state's attorneys are independent, which is great. But I think we need to do some more coordination with them. Again, with the opioid epidemic, but with other criminal behavior. What are they seeing? And this will be part of our task force. They'll come in, and I want to talk to them. I want to help coordinate with them, and actually, hopefully, the U.S. attorney will be involved so that we can have a coordinated, if possible, approach to this this terrible epidemic and to any other related criminal activity.
It's an interesting point. The Attorney General is the chief law enforcement official of the state, but we have state's attorneys who are elected independently, have their own responsibilities, their jurisdiction within their counties. So it's important to work with that group and make sure that you're on the same page.
Right.
So, very interesting. Let me ask you how you think you might run the office differently. We're going to have the first new attorney general in a long time.
I think it's 18 years.
Yeah, something like that. Usually there's more turnover in offices of that nature. But the current attorney general has had a lot of adventures, campaign finance, law, the GMO law and things of this kind, that the latter just used $2 million of resources, apparently, to fight. But would your priorities be different in terms of some of these lawsuits and defending various laws?
Yes. But procedurally, the first thing I would do is to interview everyone on staff. You know, Governor Gilmore came up and to help support me in my campaign. And the thing he said, and he was Attorney General before he was Governor of Virginia, he said, I interviewed every attorney in my staff. He said that's the way to really learn what's going on. And I agree with him 100%. But I want to interview not just the attorneys, but the staff. Because quite often, the staff knows quite a bit more than the attorneys might. And so we want to do an inventory, what I call an inventory or an audit. I want to see what the caseloads are, what the priorities are, policies and procedures. You know, I see the Attorney General's office presently, the number of attorneys they have is about 60. It's approximately the same as New Hampshire's Attorney General's office.
Interesting.
Yes. So, and it may be because they have different requirements and different policies and different duties. But I think it's time for an inventory. So that's one of the things I'm going to do right off. And in response to your other question about the lawsuits, I want to focus on Vermonters' issues. I want to focus on this Citizen Small Business Protection Unit. I want to set that up. I want to focus on the opioid epidemic. I want to implement an ethics code in the Attorney General's office whereby staff and attorneys need to disclose any potential conflicts of interest. You know, I was talking to my husband the other day, and he's on the board of a bank, and he said he has to every single year disclose his connections, his associations. I think that's a great idea. And I think and I also want to use that as a model, perhaps, for the rest of state government, because, as you know, Vermont state government doesn't have an ethics code and doesn't have prohibitions against conflicts of interest. And I think at this point in its life, really needs one.
Yeah, there is an executive order that succeeding governors have issued. I was among them asking our direct appointees to disclose, quote-unquote, conflicts, but that information isn't made public. And so I remember asking, well, isn't this oxymoronic, a confidential disclosure?
<You know? laughs> Right.
But you know, at least the governor knows about his or her own appointees. But you're right, there's no public information there. I think you may be charitable about the size of the office. We're talking with Debbie Bucknum, the candidate for attorney general, because whenever there's a serious criminal case in New Hampshire, it's an assistant attorney general who's on the TV handling the case as opposed to the local prosecutor. So I don't know, but when you get there, you'll find out.
I'll find out. Yeah,
exactly.
That's right.
It's fascinating. That's right. Any other priorities of the office that come to mind? There's so many other. It has a bunch of divisions, right?
That's correct.
Various areas of responsibility. Mm-hmm. Any that need attention from what you've seen?
Well, we have two big tasks that I'm going to implement when I get there. But you're right. There are other issues that I'm hopeful to address. One of them is there's an assistant attorney general in regard to what we call CHINS cases, children in need of care and supervision. The Attorney General's office represents the state when there are termination of parental rights cases. And I get involved in those cases over the years of my practice. And what I see as a problem is Vermont has a tendency to remove children more often than other states.
Interesting.
It's one of the highest states in the union for removal of children from their homes. And here's a statistic that I find startling. In the ages 0 to 3, the children are removed from their homes. When they are aged 0 to 3, 34% of them, their parents' rights are terminated and they are put up for adoption in Vermont. In New Hampshire, it's 4%.
Wow.
Yeah. So I think that, and my experience has also been that at least certain offices hesitate to place children with relatives, even though the statute provides for that. I'd like to see children remain safe at home if possible. And perhaps we can, again, change the culture there. So that would be one place we I'd like to work on. I know the Consumer Protection Division is actually should be beefed up. The statistics from the Attorney General's office show that they recovered approximately $70,000, and I think it was the last time they reported was either 2014 or 2015. That doesn't sound like a lot. And I have talked to people who are involved with that as volunteers with that unit, and I think that also could be beefed up to help Vermont consumers.
Sounds like maybe they're spending more than they're taking in. Money loser.
Yeah,
I was startled, frankly, by your those statistics on termination of parental rights compared to our neighboring state.
Yeah.
Gosh, as you say, there may be other relatives who would be good candidates for custody. This woman I chatted with last night has custody of her 4-year-old granddaughter because mm-hmm. of her mother's situation and not what she expected to be doing, she said,
right.
at this stage of life, but she's happy to do it and provide that support. So, I wonder why there can't be more opportunities like that before adoption. On the other hand, we're grateful to the many Vermont families who take in adopted kids.
That's right.
When they need a home.
And also, I must say, the caseworkers in Vermont have a very tough job. They are doing God's work, and they need to be supported as well.
Well, we've got to take a break and move on, but it's been a real pleasure to have you in the studio this morning. Debbie Bucknam, candidate for Attorney General. Tell our listeners where they can get more information, a website perhaps, about your campaign.
Yes, I am on Facebook, so you can go and like me on Facebook. But I also have a website called Bucknam2016.com. That's Bucknam, B-U-C-K-N-A-M, 2016.com.
Well, that's great. Good luck. Debbie, thanks for stepping up to the plate and taking on this campaign. We're going to see a new attorney general. Let's hope the voters make the right choice when they go to the polls in 3 weeks.
Yes, thank you, Governor. It's a pleasure being here.
Debbie Bucknam, candidate for attorney general. We'll be right back in just a couple minutes. This is Jim Douglas in for Mike Smith on Open Mic. Welcome back. Jim Douglas in for Mike Smith today on Open Mic. We've had some nice conversations with candidates for office over the past hour and a half, and going to shift gears now and talk to someone, who might run for office someday. You never know. But for the moment, Professor Matt Dickinson at Middlebury College is a presidential pundit and blogger and expert on all things presidential. And I can't think of anyone better to chat with us about what we're going to experience for the next 3 weeks. So, Matt, thanks for coming on today.
Governor, great to be with you.
Well, I suppose it's a rhetorical question, but have you ever seen a campaign quite like this?
Short answer, no. Longer answer, hell no. this has just been, in so many ways, extraordinary. And in trying to find historical analogies, you really can't come up with one. I mean, there's bits and pieces of this that you might argue we've seen in previous elections. But taken as a whole, I think this is an unprecedented experience.
Well, we are where we are, and I know you spent some time over the past year attending events by presidential candidates. Tell us about some of those experiences.
Well, I set out on my sabbatical to write a book about the White House staff, and then Donald Trump came down the stairs at Trump Towers, and I got sidetracked. And I spent most of my sabbatical following not just Trump, but every candidate around mostly the Eastern Seaboard, culminating with a visit to the Republican National Convention in Cleveland. And it was an extraordinary experience for somebody who studies elections, because so much of what I was seeing in person, and in particular in talking to supporters, most notably Trump supporters, was quite different from what I was hearing and seeing on cable news networks and the various talking heads, the pundits, and so on. And so I've been trying to make sense of that, and giving a series of talks in the process of trying to work out my thoughts. I'll be doing another one tomorrow at Middlebury. And I think the most extraordinary thing is obviously the Trump candidacy. There's really been nothing like it in recent memory. And just trying to understand where his source of support is coming from and what it says about the state of the electorate today, I think, has been a fascinating exercise.
Well, let's try to answer that question. There were 17 candidates initially for the Republican nomination. Nobody thought that that Trump would end up being the nominee, but one by one, the others fell by the wayside. How do you think that happened?
Well, first, true confessions. I was one who predicted Trump would fall by the wayside.
I wasn't going to tell our audience that.
So I'm not sure how much I really have to offer here, but for what it's worth, I think you put your finger on an important component of his success, which is that the Republican establishment could not coordinate behind a single alternative to Trump. They really split. So if you look, for instance, at the endorsement patterns, Trump got almost no endorsements from elected officials in the Republican Party. But no one else got an overwhelming number either. Ted Cruz and Jeb Bush probably got the most endorsements, but nowhere near a majority or even a strong plurality. So the Republican Party was split in the beginning. The second factor, I think, is a lot of people underestimated the anti-establishment fervor that really gripped a good chunk of the Republicans in particular this election cycle. And that's driven by, I think, a big component is economic anxiety. Although job numbers are creeping up, they're not really jobs that are high income. So if you look at, for instance, the average income for white voters in particular, white men most notably, it's stagnated or even declined over the last two decades. So Trump comes along, and he really is a man of his time. He just capitalizes on that sense of economic anxiety, particularly among white men, and he's not part of the establishment. He's not part of the problem. So basically all he has to do is say, hey, I'm not part of the problem. I will be the solution if you vote for me. And a lot of Trump reporters, supporters tell me they don't even care that he's not very detailed. They just want a change, and he is clearly change.
Well, I assume a lot of Americans are saying to themselves and out loud, well, gosh, look at where we are. The political class hasn't delivered. There's stasis. There's more debt. There's gridlock and polarization. It couldn't be any worse, could it?
That's exactly what they say, the Trump supporters in particular. When I push them on this question, well, aren't you taking a risk in backing somebody who has no political experience, whose slogans belie a deep lack of depth on policy, or at least as much as one can tell, they say, what do we have to lose? It just can't get any worse. We've tried the political establishment, the political class for two decades. And I think a really important component of this here is when you look at polarization in Congress and how Democrats and Republicans consistently oppose each other, a significant portion of voters say, we're not getting represented. And in particular, I think the white voters are saying, you know, there's lots of classes out there that have special programs designed to help them, but nobody is speaking for us. And that's where Trump comes in. I think a big punch, part of his support is appealing to that forgotten class.
Well, the year of the outsiders, sometimes people suggest. Let me ask you about the other side of the aisle. We had a senator from Vermont who did very well in the Democratic primaries and was more successful than I expect most people predicted he would be. What's your take on that Democratic process?
So what's interesting is that when you look at what Bernie, and you're talking about, of course, about Bernie.
I am.
When you look at what his supporters believe, there is some overlap with the Trump supporters in this respect. Both Trump supporters and Sanders supporters are what we call economic populists. That is, they believe the system is rigged to favor the economic elite. And, of course, that's captured in, you know, the Sanders 1%, which resonated in particular among millennials, those age 18 to roughly 35 or so, who are very disenchanted with the political establishment. So Sanders was able to rally them. But unlike Trump supporters, Sanders supporters are not necessarily against government. They're not against politics, so they're not political populists. In fact, many of them think the solution to our problems is more government, more regulation, single-payer health care, free tuition, go down the list. And so that, again, appeals in particular to millennials, and we can talk about how idealistic they are or unrealistic, depending on which adjective you want to use. But Sanders was particularly good at rallying those individuals. The difficulty he had, and this is where Hillary Clinton hung on, was Sanders was not able to expand his coalition to include non-white voters. And for whatever reason, they just did not buy into his message and weren't willing to abandon Hillary Clinton. And that ultimately made the difference in the nominating race.
Seemed like some of the rallies, and I don't know if this is true of ones you attended, were not congenial, to put it charitably. Lots of yelling and interruptions and even violence in a couple of cases. Are we just getting too angry as an electorate?
So one of the disturbing trends I think you're seeing is that populist fervor that has been driving Trump supporters is beginning to spill over into questioning about the political system as opposed to just the individuals who have been running that system. Now, I have to confess, I've been to about 7 Trump rallies, but none recently when, the series of revelations regarding the audio tape and so on have led him down sort of a different path where he now is beginning to question whether the electoral system is rigged. So I can't speak directly. I can say in the earlier rallies, a lot of that violence, I think, that was played over and over again on cable was not something I was seeing at any rallies, but particularly Trump rallies. So, for instance, when they would chant, "Lock her up," it was much more like being at a football game where they would say, "Push him back, push him back." It was very festive. It was much more like a pep rally. I don't know if that continues to be the case. My sense from looking at cable, for what you can believe on cable, is that it's taken an uglier turn. But how pervasive that is, I'm just not in a position to say. I worry about it, though.
I'm not sure about cable either, but you can always rely on what you hear on WDEV News Radio.
That's true.
We're chatting with Matt Dickinson, a professor of political science at Middlebury College and author and pundit and blogger extraordinaire about presidential campaigns and related matters. Matt, I want to ask you about polls. I've listened to you and taken to heart your counsel that we should never look at a single poll because there are lots of them out there. But give us a sense of the polling in this presidential race and your assessment of where things stand now.
So you have heard me say for a couple of months coming out of the Republican and Democratic conventions at the end of July into August that the race was going to tighten. At that point, coming out of the Democratic convention, Hillary Clinton had a 10-point lead in the aggregate polls. And by aggregate, I mean the poll of polls, which several websites have and which I rely on more than individual polls. I predicted that race was going to tighten, and sure enough, it did. So about 2.5-3 weeks ago, Trump was within, again, depending on which aggregate poll you looked at, it was either a dead heat or maybe he was within 2 percentage points. But this is where the wheels have come off the Trump campaign, and pundits are always talking about the potential for an October surprise or a black swan event. And I'm not sure we've had a black swan event, but maybe some black chickadee events, a series of them, if you can have such a thing.
Sure.
You know, we just drip, 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 beginning with the revelation that Trump had paid no income taxes, perhaps as long as 18 years, and then a mediocre first debate performance in which he, rather than letting that go, just kept hammering away at winning issues, but winning for Clinton, like the Alicia Machado, the beauty queen, fat-shaming it. And then, of course, the audio tape coming out in which he is making some reprehensible comments about women. And so it's just been one event after another. Now, that hasn't necessarily cost him support. He's maybe dropped about 1% in the aggregate polls. But what it has meant is those undecided voters, who generally are lower information voters and not strong partisans, and there's been a lot of them undecided in this election cycle compared to previous ones, they have begun drifting almost uniformly into Clinton's column. And so we see her lead edging back up so that today, again, in the aggregate poll, she's back up to about 8% lead. And, of course, you know, a rising tide lifts all swing states. So as the national polls go up, she's also increased her lead in those key swing states. And with 20 days to go, give or take, history says that is an almost insurmountable margin for Donald Trump to overcome.
Well, on that note, we're going to have to take a quick break and come back and let that settle in. We'll chat more about the presidential campaign with Matt Dickinson, professor of political science at Middlebury College. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. Jim Douglas here this morning, chatting with Matt Dickinson, professor of political science at Middlebury College. And before the break, Matt, you said that Hillary Clinton seems to be opening up a likely insurmountable lead. One thing that we've heard about and you've talked about, I think, in this campaign is the enthusiasm factor. There are a lot of folks who just have no use for either one of these candidates, right?
That's correct. If we measure enthusiasm, for instance, by asking how favorably or unfavorably you view the candidates, it turns out, and we've been doing this for several decades, Donald Trump is viewed as the most unfavorable candidate who's ever run for president in that period, followed closely behind by Hillary Clinton. So to the extent that people are supporting Clinton, they're holding their nose while they're doing it. And she's sort of viewed as the lesser of two evils at this point for many voters. There's just not that much enthusiasm. And that leads us to two considerations when we're trying to think about how this election is going to turn out. One is turnout. So we know there's some correlation between intensity of preference and likelihood to vote. And so if you're looking at disparities in passion, and we did see earlier in the race that Donald Trump's supporters were more passionate about him than Clinton's were, but that edge seems to have dissipated recently. But turnout, of course, is one key question, and as you well know, that can throw forecasts off. But the other thing is the presence of third-party candidates. And there's a couple of them out there, some of whom may do better in Vermont. I'm thinking of Jill Stein, who's running as the Green Party candidate, and Gary Johnson, who's the Libertarian candidate. Now, nationally, both of those candidates, but particularly Johnson, are doing okay for third-party candidates. Johnson's running, you know, roughly 7 to 8%. But in particular states like New Mexico, he's doing quite well. And Stein's running maybe 3 to 4%. So the question is, who are they taking their support from? And in early in the campaign, it looked like Johnson was drawing a little bit more from Clinton than from Trump. But now, again, that seems to have evened out a little bit. So it's really uncertain that the third-party vote is going to make a huge difference nationally. But it could make a difference in closely contested swing states. And so, there's other candidates who have, you know, there's a third-party candidate who's come out of nowhere in Utah. Getting
Evan McMullen.
Yeah, McMullen, who's getting, you know, roughly the same, if polls are to believe, support that Trump has. So, you know, it's always tricky to forecast support for third parties. Historically, people are more willing to say they're going to vote third party than they actually do come election day. So we see polls typically at this point overstating support for third party. Mm-hmm. But as you noted at the beginning of this conversation, this is not an election that's followed precedent very much.
And turnout also is affected by the so-called ground game, where most people think Hillary has a better operation.
Yeah, to the extent that you can quantify ground game, and it's very hard to do, but we look at things like, you know, campaign offices, and she's basically outspending him and out-organizing him by roughly 3-1 when it comes to measures like, you know, field offices in swing states, so, although, again, there's some variation across states. That's a squishy figure, though, because you don't know how effective they are in turning out the vote.
Well, time flies, Matt Dickinson. I'm afraid we're out of it, but thanks so much for joining us on the show. And tomorrow afternoon at 4:30 at Dana Auditorium on the Middlebury College campus, you're going to tell us more about this.
Looking forward to it, and great to talk to you, Governor.
Well, thanks so much for joining us, Matt. Matt Dickinson. And we appreciate the other guests coming in this morning as well. Jim Douglas for Mike Smith on Open Mic.
The Open Mic podcast is brought to you by Hickok Boardman, Dennis Ricker and Brown.
Find us online at hbinsurance.com. And you're always welcome to visit us on Facebook, in Vermont, online, on the phone. Hickok and Boardman Insurance Group. We are here when you need us.